A family office is really a high wealth family that has a significant amount of money, but they actually are doing their own investing. So they may invest in the stock market and bonds. They may invest in some real estate, but they also have other investments that they want to do, some more high risk or high reward type investments. So this may be something that would fit maybe a small portion of their portfolio. You know, they'd be willing to give a couple million dollars to something like this to see if it hits big. This could be, you know, a 10 to 20 times investment. So that would be a family office. And venture capital firms are, you know, would be a little bit larger than a family office, but you know, people would give money to those and hopefully things would grow through that. But that's the hard part with these companies. It takes a lot to kind of get their plan formally in place. We're not talking tens or hundreds of thousand dollars. We're talking millions of dollars. Our hope is that we can get these companies launched in 3 to 4 years. We've heard other companies launched in maybe 5 to 10 years. That's a pretty long investment to see if you can get a return on it.
And welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the co-founder and CEO at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's purchasing with magical features, but I'm not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've invited along Adam Guess, a full-time and fractional CFO for a number of businesses. And Adam's background in particular has an unusual experience in that he works with both profit and non-profit businesses. But what we're going to talk about today towards the back end of the show is dealing with a venture fund. In particular, venture funds are basically in the business of looking after their money very carefully. And that does bring up particular challenges when it comes to working on a finance team if you're on the receiving end of that money. And we're going to get into that a little bit later on. But just to start off, Adam, you're very welcome on the podcast. Maybe you could just tell the listeners a little bit about you, yourself. Where are you? A bit about your background.
Sure. Thanks so much, James, for inviting me on. I just look forward to visiting with you guys today. So a little bit more about me. I went to a school here at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. That's where I'm located currently. And that's the two fractionals. This fractional CFO, my CFO gig are currently here in Waco. I got my global MBA degree from University of Texas at Dallas. That was many years ago, and it was done online. So it was a unique experience back in 2003 to complete an online degree. I went to campus twice, once for an international finance final. I was having difficulty in that class. And the second time was to actually walk. I graduated there. That was fun. So I've had that MBA for many years and done well with it. So been at the American Football Coaches Association for almost 20 years now. So it's been a great experience. Work with the two different bosses, Coach Grant Taff and Coach Todd Berry. And now, as of about a month ago, Coach Craig Bowles, my current boss. He's the executive director of the American Football Coaches Association. We are a nonprofit trade association here in the United States. And so that's a little bit more about the association. We work a lot with the NCAA, the NFL, and legislation that affects college football. But we also help a little bit with the high school ranks and then at the NFL, too. National Football League. In fact, Coach Bull, my boss, is on his way to the NFL Combine today. So he's heading up there to visit and have some meetings. So my fractional work is with Brazos Innovation Partners. So it's a unique organization that's kind of stemmed out of the movement of innovation. No, not going great in the United States. So innovation, particularly out of colleges and universities. So they take intellectual property or concepts from in universities and try to help commercialize them, get them ready for a formal company. Through that process, we do work a lot with venture capital firms. One in particular right now is we're just a one-year-old company, but there are some challenges with that, but we've also had some great success with only being in operation for about 14, 15 months now. So it's been a great success and look forward to sharing some more about those thoughts today.
Great. Okay. Well, before we get into that, let me just bring you back to your MBA 20 years ago, doing it online. I guess that was a bit tricky because even now, today, the completion rates on those online courses are low. And I'm guessing you were the sort of guinea pigs almost at that stage. Must have been one of the first to try and do it.
When I was looking around for a graduate level degree, online stuff, it just kind of started up. This was a unique one that was in the University of Texas system. So I was able to take classes from all the University of Texas schools, including schools at UT Austin, UT Pan American or the Rio Grande Valley now, and UT Dallas. So I kind of chose the Dallas one. It seemed like the best option for me. It was kind of close by if I had to go to a class there. But at that time, it was a little different. It was a lot of different kind of learning. You'd get still traditional school semesters, and you'd have classes and homework and you'd have to post assignments online and post into chat rooms to make sure you get participation grades. But many years ago, it was kind of, I guess, one of the first ones that I looked into getting, and before it was relevant. But it was a unique experience and talked to some people, but the personal interaction was definitely different. Different than an in-room class.
Well, when I hear of MBAs, I don't know what it's like in the US, but in Europe and South Africa, maybe they call them MBA widows, a little bit like golf widows or widowers, is that it's so all-encompassing that people are just sucked into it and you have time for nothing else, including your spouse or your family. And maybe the contact is a bad thing. I've heard of all sorts of people going into MBAs and, you know, maybe a little bit too much interpersonal interactions going on between the students sometimes, especially if you're married. So I'm guessing you were before you were married, you could avoid that.
It was actually the first year after we were married, I started my MBA. But being online, it was pretty much I'd come home from my day job and have dinner with my wife. We'd watch a TV show or two, and she was a school teacher, so she went to bed early. And I would stay up about 3 or 4 hours and do my schoolwork. As fate would have it, I actually graduated on my son's first birthday. So I was able to get my schooling done when he was still young. And, you know, he was still up at night. Sometimes I'd feed him and then go back and study a little bit more. But feel blessed I got it done while he was still young. And I have 4 children now. He was my oldest. Got the schooling done before the child rearing stage started. So that was good for us.
Okay. MBA and a new child. That's just showing off in my book. That's impressive. You can't do anything in the first 2 years of having a kid. Did that work? Is that the thing that got you the big seat in your current role? Doing the MBA, that really allow you to progress your career? Was that the payoff, or was it something else that allowed you to get into that seat?
And this seat really was, you know, I'm a man of faith myself, and I feel like it was just a movement of God. They kind of handed this through. So I was actually applied for a job at an accounting firm. I was with a company here in Waco that was in the process of going public. So they actually were listed on the NASDAQ stock exchange and got to work a lot there in my role there in accounting and analytics and finance with the CFO of that organization, and really felt that organization that I was working with were worth the time was not something I wanted to continue long-term with. I was exposed to the upper management and just felt like it was not the best fit for myself. So I applied for a local accounting firm that a partner of the accounting firm forwarded my resume over to a local banker who I did not know at the time. And the local banker forwarded my resume on to Coach Grant Taft, which was the man that hired me. And he said that you need to hire this guy. He looks like he'd be a really, really good fit for your organization. I about 1 year into my MBA at that point in time. The MBA did, I think, help me gain a greater understanding. And I can tell you this. I firmly believe that working for a company that was going public contributed so much more to my knowledge base as I got my MBA than had I gone straight through it after my bachelor's. But having some real world experience really, really put me over the edge as far as my learning and application of the classes I was going in my MBA.
Yeah, well, I admire anyone who completes an MBA, because I realize it's a ton of work, but it's the hands-on stuff that really makes a difference, I guess. But then that lets you differentiate and maybe get into that position where you can get those better jobs in the first place. So maybe this is a good segue into, you know, what made you such a good fit for the organization you're in now, the coaches representative body. Maybe tell us a bit more about that and why. What did the coach see in you? His number one job is spotting talent. So why did he spot you for the finance team?
It was an interesting process in itself. I really did feel like I was getting recruited as I was coming in, just like a player would get recruited to come to a team. In fact, it came to a one question that was, I said, so are we getting computers or anything? He's like, well, what computer do you want? You name it, we'll get it for you, you know? So it was really a great computer recruiting tactic. But I think what really put me over the edge was I had a background in accounting, and then also had a double major in business statistics. And so my job was involved in cost analytics and finance. And so I had a little bit of a broader array of everything I worked on. As a student at Baylor University, I'd also had an internship with Northwestern Mutual Life Insurance. I had gotten my Group 1 license so I could actually sell health insurance. So I had a little bit of understanding of what the health insurance was. And the role they were looking for actually was a need at the association. They had moved to Waco from Orlando, Florida, about 3 years prior, and the person that was doing their current accounting was in a bad car wreck and was out for about 3 months. And so they were really behind on their accounting work. And the person that was doing it really wasn't a degreed accountant. They were just someone that had worked in an accounting firm. So they didn't really fully understand the complexities of more than just making an entry. So as I had a background in accounting and an understanding and just a love for collegiate athletics and to put forth, it really came forth to be a really great fit. And I really just started out kind of more setting up my own chart of accounts, just kind of starting over with the whole process back in 2004 when I started. So it was a unique process. And then we actually selected an audit firm here in Waco to help go alongside me and make sure I was doing my job well. It was also a mandate in our bylaws as a nonprofit to have an audit. And that really kept me on my toes and gave me some guidance too as to what we needed to get done. But I think being from the ground floor to start that accounting processes, everything that would have to go into a consideration was something that I kind of had my hand in from the beginning and really didn't start off as a CFO, but really as a director of administration, became a managing director. And then at that point, after about 10 years, the CFO title was given to me. My job duties didn't change much, but I think I got more responsibility, a little more responsibility as we kind of move forward.
Listen, I don't know much about college football, but I know two things. One is it's a funny shaped ball. And the second thing is that there's a lot of money in it. Are you there to represent coaches who get down to their last million? Seems like a mystical world with big numbers. Everyone's getting paid huge salaries. Who do you represent? And why do these coaches need the representation?
Sure. That's a great question. We work with a lot of those coaches, but that's the small minor part. There's over 700 colleges that play and universities that play college football in the United States. And the ones that make the millions of dollars are probably about the 100 schools, maybe 100 schools. And so if you count our membership of coaches, our membership's currently over 12,000 members. 100 coaches make $1 million, and we have about 11,900 that aren't making those big bucks. And if you look at most of the smaller colleges, and here they're classified by divisions, Division II, Division III, NAIA, a lot of these coaches really are making a very modest living. In fact, they sometimes have to have second or third jobs just to make ends meet because they love coaching so much. So they're at these smaller schools that maybe, if you look at it, they're probably making close to minimum wage from what they do. And so we represent, all those coaches from the small schools all the way to the large ones. The association really, its main purpose is to give the voice of the coaches to the NCAA and to the other parties that we work with. Coaches are in a unique position, especially in the current status of college athletics in the United States, because they're employed by schools and they represent student athletes. Some things the coaches really feel like that they want to say, they can't say because it would harm the school or it would not be in the best interest of the student athlete. So that's where we kind of come in as our unbiased opinion, where we can kind of speak what we call as truth to the situation. And we're not really filtered by being employed by a school or representing a student athlete, but really trying to make sure what's best for the game of football as we move forward. There's a lot of things going on with football, with name, image, and likeness, and this transfer portal and the ability to go through these different mechanisms of management. And the NCAA is really in a position right now that they're fearful, in my opinion, of putting in legislation. They're fearful of more lawsuits. So we're trying to kind of help guide and help lead them in the right direction, or just help provide the right perspective that maybe what could be needed to help in different situations like that. So my role as a CFO is not involved in any of that work. I'm just here to make sure the lights are on and we've got a good reserve fund and everyone gets paid and we have a healthy convention every year. We have a big convention. That's our big deal. About 10,000 people attend, coaches and sponsors and exhibitors, where we show everything that goes on in the game of football. So it's a great, great time of year for us for that. But yeah, that's kind of a little bit more about the association.
Enough of this boring football stuff. Let's focus on the fun stuff, the FP&A. You touched on it slightly already, but what's the big difference between running a commercial operation and a nonprofit or non-for-profit?
Nonprofit organization. So one of the main differences is the nonprofit's really driven by, we have an exempt status with the Internal Revenue Service, the taxing organization in the United States, and that we get that exemption because our purpose is really for the common good of individuals. Our intention is not to make money, that's not the purpose of our organization. I would go as far to say as though that it's not illegal to make money, it's just not the main purpose of our organization. So we try to raise our funds and the funds that we use to propel to help college football and in football in the United States and in around the world, a great game that continue to be played well and can continue to be sustained. So as long as the funds that we spend are for that purpose, There's no income tax that we have to pay or any taxation for that. The reserve funds, some of the funds we have that we are investing into different stocks and such, the dividends even from those are not taxed either. So capital gains are not taxed. That's the really great thing about this. There is some things that are taxed. So if there is a source of revenue that's not for the purpose of educating football, for instance, we have a magazine and we have a podcast ourselves, and we have some other digital assets that we sell. The sponsorship of those is called unrelated business income. And so there is an unrelated business income tax because it's not for the purpose of college football. It's for the purpose of advertising or helping some of these sponsors make money. So we are taxed upon some of those revenues. But for the most part, we're able to count for the monies the proper way where we're not taxed at a majority of what we bring in. So that's a common practice here, I guess, in the United States that for nonprofit organizations. We're not charitable. In the tax code, we're a 501c6 organization. It's a trade association exemption, similar to a labor union. We're not a labor union. We're just a trade association. But churches and other ministries or other schools are of the 501c3 tax code. And so some businesses can give donations to those organizations and get a tax exemption or a tax cut by making to those. The association that we work is not one of those organizations. So people give us money. It's not tax deductible to them. It still would be a marketing expense or a dues expense. But that's the great thing about what we do here is a lot of those reserves and the investing that I oversee and look into, we don't have to take into account taxes. So we don't have to sell or look at municipal bonds or different things to try to avoid any taxation. So it's a great way to continue to grow our reserves.
So I'm guessing then if you have a business that can be even reasonably profitable and then compound those investments over years after what, 5, 10, how long has been the organization been around? After a few years, you get a considerable reserves that you got to look after.
We've done very well. So actually our organization has celebrated its 100th anniversary in 2022. We were started in 1922, been around for a while. Since I've started here, our reserve fund has about doubled. We've been advised by some great investment minds and have pulled out at the right time and invested some more money at the right time and really have done well in the markets and created a healthy reserve that we can sustain some difficult years. When COVID hit the whole United States and the whole world, we had a reduction in revenue of over 50%, but it really didn't affect, we didn't have to go to any layoffs. In fact, we didn't really qualify for a lot of the grants and the governmental money that went through just because we still were able to sustain what we did. In a good manner. It's just been a great way to plan for different things and to run as lean as we can. So to also make sure that we have enough to get the job done. We've got a great team here that really works on it as well. So don't by any means just not toot my own horn, but we've got 14 to 15 employees here that really kind of are all dedicated to making sure that we get this thing up and running in the right direction.
100 years is insane. Let's face it. Like, it's so long. My great-great-grandfather started a bakery that lasted 140 years. It ended in the 1970s. Today, that just doesn't happen. You just don't have, like, the average lifespan of a business is something, like 5 years or something or less. And I wonder if the fact that you're not focused on profit, like, just makes it like such a snowball after a while, just makes it a long-term business, like the lack of sort of need to take profits out of the business. I guess you'd almost be unstoppable after 100 years of compounding investments. You made it sound like a dream job for a finance person so far. Very, very stable company. You know, the IRS loves you. But come on, there's got to be some downsides. What's the downside of, what's the challenge in running this type of organization? You're making it sound way too easy so far.
It's not easy, I would say that. But probably a challenge is for someone like myself, the compensation is also nonprofit. So we're not necessarily bonused. We're not necessarily growing, a cost of living raise is about what we get annually. So you're not making millions of dollars by working a place like this. Working in an incredible space. I love the people I've worked for. I love the people that I work with. To work with some of these coaches are just great American people that really are able to take off their hat of this institution that they're at and try to do something for the common good. That's hard to do. It really is. To be a part of a group that really feels like that we're actually training young men up to do the same thing when they leave their school, when they leave that game of football. And that's a really neat thing about the game of football, in my opinion. It takes everybody, not just the tall guys, the fast guys, but you got guys that kick the ball, guys that catch the ball, guys that throw the ball, guys that are fast, guys that are big. it kind of takes everybody together, and they have to come to a common goal of everything working together. So that whole concept is really something that speaks a lot to me and makes it enjoyable. I love what I do. I love that I do get to do accounting for people like this. It is a great job, but it does come with its challenges. I mean, it's not necessarily, like I said, the challenge of making more money and stuff like that is not quite as there, but I've been able to find some of those challenges through fractional work that I do or through other things as well to kind of make sure that I make my ends meet and continue to support my family.
You've convinced me. It's a great organization to run for. It gives you a good base. You're working for a mission, which I love it. You know, everyone, you're all on the same team. Tell me then, this led you on, maybe with the expertise you've built up, especially when it comes to investments, managing investments, into your collaboration with Brazos. So tell us a bit about that. This is a fractional role that you have. How did that come about, and what did Brazos do?
Sure. So Brazos was a kind of a spinoff of Baylor University. They had this kind of lab to market. They had different intellectual properties that were kind of created and were trying to get them to actually make companies. There's some different processes and legalities. It was best that this kind of spinoff of Baylor University, and it spun off formally in January of 2023. And at that point in time, they knew that they needed someone to kind of look over their financial side. Their CEO and president, one was an engineer by trade, and the other one was another PhD that had a great understanding of startups and companies that had worked in this lab to market space for many years. But they both knew that they didn't have the background to really look on the backside of actually the business side. You know, make sure that taxes were filed and accounts were set up and bills were paid and those kind of things. Through different connections I had here in Waco, I was able to interview with those guys and landed the role and got to start with them from the inception. So it was kind of neat. There were some similarities that we actually had between the AFCA and Brazos Innovation. We both have a student workers that we use from Baylor University. That was kind of the one thing that kind of started the conversation, and it led to some similarities in both of those. Been a great, great job so far, and they've worked with Baylor, and they've actually started working for some other universities as well and trying to get their intellectual property outside of the university into for-profit companies. It's a crisis, really, in America. There's not much innovation going on, and it really kind of hits this the difficulty of trying to get these intellectual properties from schools. Great ideas, but the professors there aren't great business makers. They're great with coming up with ideas. And so we're trying the ones that try to help put together the plan and get some funds from different companies into them to help them launch. That's the main focus that we're trying to do, and still working hard on it. We have about 5 or 6 companies that we're working with right now and looking to onboard about 3 or 4 more here in 2024.
Okay, so into this seemingly idyllic, cosseted world of academic life, where I don't know if it's like that there, but in Europe, you get your tenure, you can't be fired, life is good, cappuccino's at 10 o'clock, you're bringing in PE firms or venture firms. So let's just set that out for a bit. Like, so you're trying to encourage commercial interest in the university. What sort of backers, what sort of capital allocators are you looking for in that business?
We're still new to this, and so the main source that we're looking for is through venture capital firms right now. And we're also looking for family offices, and we're actually trying to start a new method called a transfer studio, where high wealth individuals could support, we'll say, because I'm here in Waco, the Baylor University Tech Transfer Studio. So they could put some funds into this studio, and this studio would actually launch 4 or 5 companies within 4 or 5 years. And so by people that would invest into this company called the Baylor University Tech Transfer Studio, they would then own a portion of these 4 or 5 companies as they launched, and they would have the ability to actually help them get going and help them get off the ground. That's the concept. We've bounced it by several individuals and actually working with other groups that have started to do this as well. So there are some other competitors that actually raise funds for this, because there's a huge affinity to help out the schools. Some alumni and such, they really want the school to succeed and to produce great concepts and great ideas.
What's the difference between a family office and a venture fund?
A family office is really a high wealth family that has a significant amount of money, but they actually are doing their own investing. So they may invest in the stock market and bonds. They may invest in some real estate, but they also have other investments that they want to do, some more high risk or high reward type investments. So this may be something that would fit maybe a small portion of their portfolio. You know, they'd be willing to give a couple $1 million to something like this to see, hey, if it hits big, this could be, you know, a 10 to 20 times investment. So that would be a family office. And venture capital firms are, you know, would be a little bit larger than a family office, but, you know, people would give money to those and help hopefully things would grow through that. But that's the hard part with these companies. It takes a lot for some of these companies to kind of get their plan formally in place. We're not talking tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. We're talking millions of dollars. And, you know, some of the runways for these, you know, our hope is that we can get these companies launched in 3 to 4 years. We've heard other companies launched in maybe 5 to 10 years. That's a pretty long investment to see if you can get a return on it. Hopefully by putting the right people that have some knowledge and getting some momentum in the right spot. It's not all about sales and trying to sell the pitch, but it's also about the operational side of putting some engineers behind it that can get the product done. So we're trying to partner ourselves with the right people on all aspects, not just the engineers, but the investors, the sales pitch, the marketing research, to make sure that we're talking the right language to the right people at the right time, and that we're prepared. Because sometimes business is not necessarily the first one to the market. Timing is very critical, and sometimes it's just being lucky. We're trying to prepare ourselves that we can get as much success as we can with these companies that we're working in.
Okay, so let's talk about the venture firms for a second. I guess the family offices also are responsible for deploying that capital, and they have to look after it well. But the way I understand it, the LPs, I think that's liquidity providers to the venture firms, will put their money in expecting an outsized return better than you'll get in the stock market. And then once they have committed that money, the VCs don't make any money until they commit those funds into the market, right? Which I guess is what Brazos is providing, an opportunity to diversify some investment and get funds deployed. Because if they're not deploying the fund, they're not making any money. They don't get their fees for doing that. So I can see why it's attractive. But let's talk operationally here. They have one job, which is to look after that money. So what processes would a VC firm put in place when it actually comes to getting money into your bank account and then getting it into the projects that need the funding?
We would typically pitch to a venture capital firm. This is our project, and this is kind of our expectation. We would enter into an agreement with them that, hey, these are the billable rates that we have for our engineers. And this next phase of the business that we're working on, we anticipate it may be, $1 million. We'll just use a round figure there. Then they would commit to say, yes, they'd sign the contract. We're good. We expect that $1 million. And we have a burn rate of maybe 9 months that we can use that $1 million for. For the meantime, we would be billing them, and the money would be coming through the venture capital firm to come back to pay us for the work that's being done to get these projects up and running. Then at the end of that statement of work, hopefully, we're to a point. But as we found out with most startups, it's probably going to take a couple statements of work, a couple tweaks. You're not going to hit the home run on the first pitch. But after a couple of statements of work, we may get a place where it's ready to go to the commercial market. And so at that point in time, the venture capital firm may go back for a bigger raise to really exit it from the venture capital firm and exit to its own company. And that's when some of the founders would really be able to either exercise their option to sell, or if they like the concept and like where they're going, they may want to invest some more funds and get some more ownership of directly where it's going. So we're not quite to that phase yet as just a one-year-old company. We still have our companies that we're working with. We've got some that are making great progress and have great ideas. Really, I think we're heading definitely in the right direction. But as you mentioned, one of the difficulties we've had is working with the venture capital firms. So we may have this commitment and to $1 million in 9 months, but we may go through it in about 3 or 4 months, and they may not have been prepared. Their allocation may not have been quite set to send us those funds. So in that situation, we've created a pretty big receivable on our end that's not getting paid for a little while because the venture capital firm's not getting their allocation from their investors at that point in time. So at that point in time, it becomes a really a cash management issue for us at Brazos Innovation is for how we're going to solve that, how we're going to float ourselves in the meantime. So it's our problem. We created the work. We created the issue. But we're also trying to make sure that we keep our doors open and we keep our lights on and keep billable revenue going.
So this gets into my wheelhouse, which is cash forecasting, I guess, seeing what your expenses are going to be. Is there CapEx here? Is it items that need to be purchased with a purchase order? Is it just salaries mostly? Is it deep tech or is it just people that you're paying for? How do you gain that visibility on how much money you're going to need in 2, 3, 6 months?
Majority of Brazos' expenses is salaries as we go through it. And the projects that we work on, any of the supplies or consults or equipment that's needed is usually passed on to the company that's starting the project that we're working on. So it's passed on to the venture capital firm. So we typically don't have capital assets for Brazos. That in itself has been a pretty good model so far for us in that. But the struggle is really trying to figure out within that statement of work, how much time and effort and materials are we going to have to secure or procure in the next 6 or 9 months. So our projections are really, really important. So we do work off a 13-week cash flow projection that kind of really shows exactly what we expect coming in and what we expect going out to make sure that we're managing our business in the appropriate manner. That's a critical management piece that I use for us, as well as just our new general budget and what kind of onboarding projects that we expect coming on, because we really have to be ahead of the curve on that. If we're expecting a new company or a new project to onboard, we have to make sure we've got the right engineers in place and that they're already kind of in our workflow, so we don't waste time or money as we try to onboard these companies. So it's a delicate balance, and we're still trying to figure that out right now, but it is something that we have to kind of weigh back and forth on.
Okay, so I mean, the HR cost seems straightforward enough. X bodies times Y months, it's easy to figure out what's going to happen there. But academics aren't known for their administrative excellence, put it that way, haven't had to fill out a timesheet in their lives, God help them. It's often geniuses who are working on these things, but the administration is something that they haven't had to think about. How do you help them come to terms with now, hey, now we have a budget, now you're not just going to be able to come up with stuff when you want it, you're going to have to let me know? Do you have meetings with them? How do you get to that stage where there are no surprises?
Great question. So I do have two meetings a week with our president. We meet for about 45 minutes every morning just to kind of touch base and kind of look back a little bit, look forward a little bit. And the CEO, I meet with probably once every 2 weeks. He's unique in himself because he's one of the hardest workers I've ever been around. But he also has an understanding for the math and statistics. He's big into the papers and documentation. So he understands the model. He understands the margins. But he also has a pretty good idea of what it's going to need to get there. So it's a matter of just asking the right questions. And then we can get really figure it out probably with it pretty quick as to what we expect our need to be. And then make sure that that's clearly communicated back to the companies that we're working for, the venture capital firms and the organizations that have started already that need some support. So the communication piece is critical in this, but it's both ways. It's internally and externally.
So what advice would you have for someone working on a finance team that's about to start getting funding from a venture capital or even a family office business? What tips would you give them to stay on top of that relationship?
I would come back to communication. You've got to make sure that you fully understand what's going on and they fully understand what you're doing as well. So it's a two-way communication model, if you will. But as it relates to that too, it's not just finance related. It's business. You need to understand what the purpose that they're working on and why they're doing it. Sometimes you have to take a step back out of the finance role and just try to visit with someone in another department or another organization and kind of exactly understand their perspective. You don't necessarily have to agree with their perspective, but to try to understand and comprehend it. That's important in business.
All right. Empathy. I love it. Sounds to me like my next question is going to touch on that a little bit. So I like to ask people at the end of the podcast here, who's their business hero? You can't really ask that question at a cocktail party, but we ask it here. Who is Adam Guest's business hero?
I've had several individuals that have been influential in my business career. But one that comes to mind that I respect for their relationships and the way they manage their relationships is my father. My father is an accountant got a degree in accounting, but he's not an accountant. He's a salesman. He's been in the aluminum business in the United States for about 40 years. He's really portrayed that relationships are important to me. He's one that will fly across the country for a 30-minute meeting and then hop on a plane and fly back just because it's important to see someone face-to-face, shake their hand, or maybe take them to dinner. But seeing someone in person and establishing a relationship and understanding their perspective, understanding where they're coming from, and even agreeing to disagree at times is okay. But that personal relationship, I feel, is critical. There's so much data out there these days, and data is important. It can definitely help you make educated decisions, but it just needs to be a piece of the puzzle. And I think that relationship or talking with someone or getting the feelings that you get by meeting with someone are important as well. And those need to be taken into consideration. It doesn't need to be black and white based upon a strict profit or loss. But sometimes it's important to do things what just feels the right way. And you're not going to be right all the time on that. But it is important to take that into consideration, in my opinion.
And is your dad still around?
My dad is still around. In fact, he's 72 this year and he's still working.
And have you told him that he is your business hero?
Not directly, no, probably not. We've talked about it several times, and we've talked about the importance of relationships, but that would be a great conversation to have in the near future.
Who is it? You're working with Brazos. You seem to be enjoying that. You've obviously got a ton of expertise as a fractional CFO. Who would be an ideal client for you, and how could they reach out to you?
Fractional work is difficult. As much as it sounds fractional, it can take up a lot of time. My plate's pretty full right now, but I'm always looking for maybe onboarding something else. But LinkedIn profile, Adam Guess here in Waco, Texas, is probably the best way to get in touch with me. Not too active on any of the social channels. That's not really my flavor. Might should be at some point in time, but really, that's not really my cup of tea. Try to stay off the X and the Instagram and stuff like that. And I'd say LinkedIn's the best way, or even my email address, adam@afca.com or adam.guest@bip.team. Those are my email addresses. But yeah, I would love to visit with anyone if they had any questions or just to connect. Would be great too. Always looking for to grow my network and to grow my understanding.
Great. Okay. Well, we'll put your LinkedIn in the description section if you're watching on YouTube here. Thanks very much for chatting. I really enjoyed poking fun a little bit about the VC firms and chatting about, you know, dealing with nonprofit businesses. I actually hadn't really realized the power of that. And I've actually interviewed someone else recently who it was a KFE Solutions, and they have a very interesting tagline, which is they help you deliver your profit so you can have your impact. That really made a big impact on me. I was saying, well, yeah, that's what it's actually about. It's the impact. And the idea of you can work for a nonprofit, just go straight to focus on the impact. Actually, that's pretty cool. So thanks very much. If you've listened this far, congratulations. You get a gold star. And I now anoint you to be able to like this video and press subscribe. That's your reward for having got this far in the video. If you know a great fractional CFO like Adam, you can come on, talk. I was going to say inside baseball, but like, let's call it inside football, all the dirty details of running a finance operation. Maybe you'll be able to give someone a tip that could help them next time they have to engage in something niche within the finance team, just like Adam's done today. I really appreciate it. You can reach out to me, james.kennedy@procurementexpress.com, and we'll see you in the next one.